Could you all take your seats, please? The next hour is going to be a question and answer session with our three speakers. Questions to be asked by raised hand. We have the lovely Bridie with the roving mic. The lovely Bridie with the roving mic, who will come and. Who come and get your questions. Anything else to say? We had some questions during lunchtime as to whether there was any AA meetings on tonight. And I would recommend a meeting. It's probably the second best meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the Barking Big Book Study. Where are you guys? Could you stand up and make yourselves known? There we go. So if anybody wants to go to a good Big Book Study meeting tonight, they're the guys to go and see. Okay. With that, could we have raised hands, please, for questions? Simple ones for Chris. Could we have the lady Daphne? It's Daphne with the pink jumper. Thank you.
Hello, guys. It's lovely to actually be here and listen to you guys, but anyway, I'll shut up. My name's Daphne, and I'm an alcoholic. How do you deal with people who bring out the spiritual malady in you, in AA, or people who you don't get along with in AA, and that's to all three of you.
Yeah, that's a tough question, kid. The question that always comes up in this stuff is that why do I still have buttons that can be pushed? You know, it's like always the book tells us real clearly that we've stopped fighting anyone or anything, even alcohol. Left on our own devices, that's not my general nature. My general nature is to be argumentative and I insist. I'm selfish and self-centered to the core. And so I'm going to make sure that my agenda is heard. Part of this spiritual quest, part of this deal of trying to get healthier mentally, is that we stop doing that. And then the deal is to try to gradually get to a point where I just don't let the buttons get pushed anymore. So sometimes in the middle of it, it's real hard to see it, but I can tell you with some experience that in retrospect, you can look back on your life and you can see how easy those buttons were pushed when you first got here and how it gets easier and easier and easier to steer clear of it. Somebody wants to jam you up about something, Sweet Pea, you could be right. You see, I've stopped fighting anyone or even alcohol. I don't have to fight with you or anything like that. My sponsor always said that if you argue with an idiot, you become an idiot. And I believe that. I don't want to do that. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's all I have with that. I'll tell you something that my sponsor told me years ago. It set me free. He says, you know, Chris, you have to love everybody in our fellowship. You don't have to like them. And that's heresy. And some people think, oh, that's not right. I'm going to tell you something, folks. Today, in sobriety, as a free man, free in my own head, I choose who I want to hang around. And if you are on a different orbit than me, then, you know what I'm saying? It's not my responsibility to drag you into my orbit. It's just like, go have a nice life. I will love and respect you and help you any way I can, but I don't have to associate with you. And that's perfectly okay. And I think that's the way it is. It's what's supposed to be.
Kind of touching on the same stuff. As I got further along in the work and further along in the, you know, the fourth step was such a great tool at the beginning to help me see why these people irritated me so much, you know, because I get to the fourth column and duh, it's because I'm involved, you know, it's about me. And so kind of what Myers was talking about as well is I get to see that. It was like, oh, wait, I know why this woman irritates me, because I'm just like her, you know, or because I used to be the same way, or because whatever, you know. And so the love and tolerance, that's our code, you know. It's hard to do it sometimes, but I know with a lot of practice and doing it wrong quite a few times and then figuring out how to do it right, I get better at it. But it definitely still gets me. But because of the work I've done up until this point, it's easy to look back and see why, You know, well, why did that person piss me off? Well, Alicia, you signed up. You know, you knew the guy, blah, 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 blah. Why did you? You know, and I can look at some of that. And what a great deal we've been given is the exact tools to help us see this kind of stuff. And I'm with Chris. There's people in our fellowship that I absolutely love and I would do anything for, you know, if they needed my help. And I'm there for them. But I'm not gonna, you know, subject myself to some of their craziness as well, because I'm signing up. You know, I'm setting myself up to get irritated and resentful and blah blah blah, and so kind of protectively loving, you know, from a distance. I don't know.
Okay, next question, Marianne. Can you stand up, please, Marianne?
Hi, Marianne, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, my question is about it. As we all, as somebody mentioned when you were speaking, there's a lot of people who are sober and who get very suicidal, very depressed. And as we were saying, that there's a lot of people who commit suicide when they are sober. And my question is about how can we do more to help the person who is sober, and the person who is relying on a power greater than themselves to keep themselves sober, but they're still full of all the madness and the insanity and still very miserable, and still likely to either go back to drinking or to kill themselves and sadly maybe be successful. I'm talking about people, I'm sure we all know them, that go to strong meetings and they are given the message. The message is passed on to them about how to get well. And it's a program of action, and you know the message is passed on to them. But for whatever reason, whether these people are full of self-will or denial or dishonesty and stubbornness and you know, all that kind of defiant stuff, for some reason these people do not believe that it is a solution, and they don't believe that the solution is going to work for them. And there's a lot of people that, you know, as we all know, really want to get well. But sadly, for, you know, they're not putting in the actions and they're not putting the information into action, and they're going back out and they're dying. That's my question. Thanks.
Here's my experience, and it'll sound harsh. I'm really a very sensitive individual. This program will work for anybody that does the work. And I came into this fellowship with this absolute terminal uniqueness is what kills alcoholics and addicts. But you don't understand, comma, my case is different. And if somebody wants to keep that frame of mind, they will die from this disease. And we're going to lose people, pure and simple. But let's not mistake this for anything else other than self-will run riot. I'm going to do it my way until the day I die. That's your choice. You go do it. But sooner or later, if you can get somebody in that pain, you can very directly, right in front of them, will you work these 12 steps rapidly, not over a long period of time, not months, weeks. Let's do this. And my experience is you'll see the depression lift, and they will get a new sense of direction and some hope in their life, and they will go from there and be successful. We can't save everybody, but this entire program is about action. It's cause and effect. You do this, this happens. It's like looking at a picture of Pamela Anderson. You look at it long enough, you're gonna get a little woody, and that's just whether you believe it or not. It's going to happen. I could probably have come up with a better analogy for that, but
the chap behind the lady in the white shirt was first. I can't remember your name.
Yeah, my name's Jonathan. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks very much. You said so much that arrived so very, very quickly. I wonder if you could just run through this intriguing idea that was completely new to me of the primary purpose expressed in the preamble versus the primary purpose in the big book. It was all new and it went rather quick. Can you go through that again for me, please? Or not?
Well, I've got to be real honest with you, because I'm not sure. I've been removed from the preamble that the Grapevine wrote for so many years now that I probably couldn't even, and I don't go to discussion meetings anymore, and I don't go to meetings where those things are read. The meetings that I go to are discussion meetings that have adopted the preamble from the foreword of the first edition. But listen to it when we read it for. I want to read something real quick, but listen to. Listen to what specifically they were talking about on this stuff, because what it said was that we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered. They're telling us who we are collectively as a fellowship. We're not a bunch of weird guys. This is where we are, from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. We understand that. To show, these are action verbs on this thing, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered. Not just sort of, not just a vague idea. Precisely how we recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. And then lastly, on this little part that I'm going to read, we think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. What we are always assuming here is that the people who are giving the direction are the guys that experienced recovery. And those are the guys that we want to be listening to. The stuff that we'll talk about, I'll talk about in here in just a little bit on this stuff, is this constant frustration of experiences being carried that were not from the book, that were not about recovery. Experience, strength, and hope. That's another Grapevine added thing to our program that is not in our big book. The big book talked about experience and knowledge on page 19. It did not talk about experience, strength, and hope. Experience, strength, and hope leaves it open to anybody that came in that just sat around a few meetings and had a few hip, slick, and cool things to share. And so the new guy comes in and he's starting to share his stuff. We need to be careful who we're listening to. Are we listening to a recovered alcoholic that understands my dilemma? Or are we listening to a disco drunk that just got spanked and in trouble and ended up here? Dig? I think that answers that thing. Somebody may be more familiar with the Grapevine version of it. I've just flat forgot it. Just as soon forget it.
Anything to add? Next question. Where are we? Got a guy over there. Stosh. You?
Thanks. My name's Mark, an alcoholic. I'm really enjoying today. I'd like to thank everybody who made it possible for this convention. The question I've got is something I've been thinking about recently as well, is about qualifying the newcomer and finding out if they're really an alcoholic of our type and whether they need a spiritual solution. And when I'm doing that, I start to think whether or not, you know, I'm a real alcoholic, and I was wondering what you suggest that I do with that internal voice that tells me, you know, I'm 4 years sober now, maybe I don't need to be working this program, maybe I don't have to do this, do that. It's hard work what we do here, isn't it? You know, 4 sponsees, 2 meetings a week, you know, prison service. And when I get people coming into the fellowship that don't want to do the work, I start struggling to, basically to get rid of them, really, you know, to bin them off. So I wonder what you think about that. Any suggestions? Thank you.
I talked to several of you during the break that are on the same page. Anytime I talk about this from the podium, it is quite controversial. There's nothing more uncomfortable for me to do than sitting in a meeting and watch somebody squirm with this, am I? It's like we're straddling the fence. One day I'm convinced I'm an alcoholic, and the next day, you know, shit, I'm not so sure. You know, maybe I'm not. And it's like until you get comfortable, you're not going to jump into this thing with both feet.
And that's what I think the gift that we can give to the newcomer is to finally get them off dead center. Let me just, for grins, how many of you guys have been in treatment more than once? Raise your hand. Bunch of us. In the hospital that I work at, it's about 80% of the patients that come to our hospital have been to treatment more than once. You with us? And my question is, why? You know, what part of this didn't you get? It was the first step. Are you powerless over alcohol? Does your experience abundantly confirm two things? When I drink it, do I drink abnormally? Do I overdrink at times? Yeah. Okay. But the book says the phenomenon of craving never takes place in a normal drinker. Normal drinkers don't overdrink, folks. They may drink heavily, but they always get to a certain spot and they'll stop. No, excuse me. No more for me. I'm starting to feel it, you know, which freaks me out, you know. Me too. Can I have another? You know, because the craving is kicked in. The craving is kicked in. But you got, if we just talk about that to the craving piece, then what we're dealing with is a behavioral problem. Well, hell, if you know you can't drink like a normal person, then you can quit. I can't. Because from 23 to 43 in the book, it explains the mental obsession. And that's the problem we have. Everybody wants to lump all of our symptoms around alcoholism, they want to call craving. Craving is a physical response to the chemical once you ingest it. If I'm sober 6 months, I am not craving alcohol. I am obsessing about alcohol. And that's what the book says. The main problem centers in his mind rather than his body. I can detox 1,000 times, have done it. I can quit. I'm a great quitter. I'm just a better starter, you know? And I go back. Well, why was it that my mind told me, even after all of the bad things that have happened to me, further away from a drink than I've ever been, why is my mind telling me I can take a drink? That's the insanity that is alcoholism. And if you could identify with that, have you ever been given good reason to quit? Yes. Did you drink anyway? Yes. Welcome to the fellowship. You are it. We don't talk about the war stories so much, guys, because it separates all of us. The book says on page 17, our common problem is one element that ties us together. But it's a common solution that keeps us bound together. And it's no more than that. That's why I don't go into meetings and talk about my DWIs and stuff. I don't go into meetings and talk about my drama, because it separates me from other people that have never experienced that stuff. War stories, and I'll talk about it in the morning, have got its place. In a meeting is not where we share it. You with me? The diagnosis for alcoholism is summed up in two words: control and choice. And that's it. No drama. Control and choice. You cool? And then when I get with a newcomer and they can answer affirmatively to those questions, then we have a new member of the fellowship. It is just that simple. But I was in AA for 7 years and nobody ever asked me those questions. Ever. And so I spent 7 years. One day I'm an alcoholic. The next day, I'm not so sure. That's a tough place to be. Thank you. You want to add to that?
I'm going to talk about it later.
I just wanted to mention something that he touched on. I work at the same treatment center with him. He's my boss. Why are they laughing? Anyway, and we see that happen a lot. He teaches First Step, and obviously he's a, you know, incredible teacher of it, and explains those same things. And we have so many people that say, okay, I get it, I'm an alcoholic, and he does the same kind of qualification stuff. But within 3 weeks of them being in treatment, they are they're causing drama. They're not showing up to group. They're doing this. And the point we keep able to bring back to them is, if you really believe that, you know, looking at the feet, I don't know why that's a big thing in my life today. If I really believe what I'm saying, then you're going to see it in my feet, you know. And people that relapse and think that it was, I didn't finish my amends, or I didn't finish the fourth step, or I didn't spill the full beans and the fifth. You know, it's like, no, it's because you didn't think you had to, because you weren't desperate. You didn't really think you were dying. And so that's the experience from working out there. My own personal experience is, I've battled that at the beginning when they started talking about the total abstinence, you know, forever, you know, and I knew, I understood the choice and the control, and I understood the damage it was causing, but there was still a little bit of the little voice guy going on, you know, and it was just, shut up, you know, and as I really understood the first step more and got more involved in it, It was almost the surrender to win process, you know, just this, oh, you mean nothing ever again. Chronic, progressive, fatal, I'm going to die. Okay, I get it. Let's do this. You know, and so my feet from there showed that I believed it because I did this work. Now, I've experienced, you know, there's been times in my sobriety that you know, I've gotten complacent, or I have stopped going so full force and doing stuff. And what usually happens in my life is I get a newcomer that's put in front of me that is my identical twin. And as I'm helping her, and I get, you know, I get to use all that stuff that's not so fresh anymore, you know, because it's, the pain is so great right at the beginning that, oh, yeah, I don't ever want to be that again. And as the years have gone by, it's like, I could have a tendency to do that. I've got to keep working with the newcomer. You know, I've got to keep reminding, I just got to stay in it and stay active. And for me, that's been the thing to keep it to real current as far as why I'm here, why I surrendered 7 years ago, why involved in this fellowship. But kind of back to the primary purpose, you know, being there and carrying this message, from my experience, keeps that little, the little voice isn't there, you know, when I'm staying there and doing that. I'm probably not going to get up again because I just kind of ramble. Okay.
We can have the guy next to Bridie, save you running around.
My name is Jerry and I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. Just like to say thank you very much for today. It's been real good stuff. This is a propos, something that was mentioned by Mark here. In sponsorship, which has been talked about quite a lot this morning, in sponsorship, how do you feel about sponsoring recovered alcoholics? I've been around a few 24 hours and I've sponsored a few guys in my time. And when they get to that 10th step, and as it tells us, you know, we've ceased fighting anyone or anybody, the problem is removed, they're recovered. So I then turn to working with newcomers. And Chris, you were saying about condition and choice. Basically, the three questions: have you got a problem? Do you want to do something about it? Are you prepared to go to any lengths? And what I'm finding now with the newcomers that I work with, the lengths that they're prepared to go to are not the lengths that I went to, or in a lot of the cases, my guys that have recovered. You know, they won't go to a meeting unless they get a lift. That sort of thing. You know, they won't get off their butts and walk anywhere. Yeah, and I find this very difficult, and I wondered if you could maybe give me a few pointers on that one, apart from dumping them.
Yeah. What a great question. There's actually two questions going on there. First off, we never stop sponsoring guys even after they've recovered. We're gonna be, I think, accountability. At the core of everything is an ego that keeps rekindling itself. And unless I have somebody to hold me accountable, in Dallas I got a crusty old guy named Cliff Bishop, and I love him to death. And he is, at one moment he's the sweetest man alive, and at the next moment he's the meanest sumbitch I ever met in my whole life. But he will not tolerate middle-of-the-road stuff, and if I say anything that speaks of arrogance, if I say anything that speaks of anything that is not what it's supposed to be, he's my go-to guy, and he's not the least bit shy about saying, "You don't sound healthy. Let's talk about what's going on." And it works beautifully. Fortunately, as we sponsor guys, let's say we sponsor 10 guys, and as we sponsor those men, we got 5 of them that recover, and those men become less and less of a burden time-wise. They're just there. We see them in meetings. We see them at wind-up places and joints that we go to carry a message, and they're a joy in our life. These other guys, they're the X factor in the sponsorship stuff. These are the cats that are either going to do the work by the actions that they take, or they're not going to do the work. And we have no control over that. We have responsibilities that are clearly defined, and those are to carry a message to this guy and let him understand what his responsibilities are in AA, what his responsibilities are not in AA. The problem, as one little side note here, the problem we have around sponsorship is that we bite off too much crap. We assume too much responsibility for the men that we sponsor. I am not an arbitrator of family affairs. I am not I don't loan money. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a clinical guy. I don't know all this stuff. I'm not an attorney. I can't help you with any of this stuff. I didn't sign up for it, and I don't want the responsibility. What I did sign up for wholeheartedly is the responsibility to make sure that a clear-cut set of message got to you so that you could then show me by your actions that you are grateful and ready to accept this gauntlet and head on down the road to help somebody else. And that's huge stuff. And some guys will, and some guys won't. We were talking a minute ago with one young lady that I talked to. You got some guys that show up that don't want to do this work. Pat them on the butt and say, have a swell life. I'm sorry. Some people are appalled with the thought that you could actually fire somebody. Listen, I'm not actually firing anybody, but as they walk away from me, I'm going to say bye. I'm not holding anybody. I'm not holding anybody. It's not good for them to do that. I don't want them here because I want them here. I want them here because they see the loving and powerful hand of God helping them through this stuff. That's what we need. Some of these cats are just going to have to go out and drink. They're going to have to go do some more research work until they're ready. Fortunately, most of these guys in short order will turn about face, come back and say, buddy, I just got the holy hell knocked out of me and I'm ready to do the work. And I'm saying, welcome. Let's go do this stuff. I think that answered that. I hope so. Thanks.
Guy in the corner. Run, Brody, run. Come on, faster. I know your sponsor.
Thanks very much. Hello. My question is to Chris. I'm Seamus, I'm an addict, and I don't mean to offend anyone in this present company by that statement. But I would just like you to enlarge on the quite categoric difference that you drew between addiction and alcoholism. And the question that I would ask you is, are you suggesting that they kind of take you to different places, you know, in here, you know, internally? So that's the question. What's the difference?
It's a great question. Welcome, buddy. What do y'all do with all this change? Y'all have so much. No, that's all. When Dr. Bob is in the carriage house and he's waiting for Bill Wilson to get there, you know, the story goes, you know, so I'll visit with this buckaroo for about 15 minutes and I'm going to dust his ass because I got some drinking to do. You know, Mother's Day in 1935. And, Bill Wilson gets in there and they start sharing some stories about the drinking and they kick around and they talk and Dr. Bob begins to realize that this out of work stockbroker sitting across the table from him understands the stuff he's going through. I mean, you know, all of us in here have tried to explain our drinking and drugging to other people who are not one of us. And it can go so far and then it just goes on deaf ear. What do you mean you don't have a choice? What do you mean? Of course you have a choice. And they don't understand. And so they got some identification going. And then Bill Wilson, you know, does what he set the hook. You know, he reeled a guy in and started explaining what he felt the solution was. And that was the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1953, we had drug addicts dying all over this country. The history books are full of the stories. It was tragic. They were dying in our fellowships because they could not identify with drinking too much. They could identify with shooting heroin. Everything about dope and alcohol is different. The physiological change in your body is different. The terminology is different. One's legal, one's illegal. The detox is different. It's different from A to Z. Until you develop a point of identification, you will not listen to the solution. Because unless you've walked a day in my shoes, don't try to talk to me about what I need to do. That's identification. It was in the traditions, and Bill Wilson understood that. You know, they didn't want the drug addicts coming to our meetings talking about dope, but they gave them permission to use our 12 steps and 12 traditions in all the other fellowships. There's over 240 other groups out there right now internationally for every addiction known to man. If you're having trouble with gambling, don't come into an AA meeting and try to get somebody to identify with you, because they won't. Go to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting and get help from people that understand where you've been. I have watched, I don't want to soapbox this. We could be here all afternoon. I just, because everybody feels real personal about it. And I'm an alcoholic and an addict, and I understand this. But I have watched drug addicts by the thousands sit in AA meetings and be miserable, and they don't chair meetings, and they don't sponsor people, and they don't, because they can't identify with the fellowship that they're sitting in. But they get across the hall in an NA meeting or a CA meeting or a Crystal Meth Anonymous meeting or a Marijuana Anonymous meeting, and all of a sudden there's this huge identification, and they're out there kicking butt and taking names. That, you understand where we're at with this? It's everybody thinks AA is a catch-all for every problem in the world. It is not. The solution is the same. You with me? It's absolutely the same. People misunderstand what I'm saying. Are drug addicts welcome in our meetings? Absolutely. If you happen to also be an alcoholic, please share. If you're not an alcoholic, shut the fuck up. Because something coming out of your head, sitting in an AA meeting not long ago, and there was a pill addict in there. This lady was an opiate addict, and she was zoned out. She'd eaten way too many little benzos that day, and she was sitting in the meeting. She was drooling in her cup. You with us? And all these alcoholics sitting around the room, and it's like the common thread was like, what do we do? Because if this lady had been in the right room, they'd have known what to do. They'd have known exactly what to do. But we didn't understand the illness, and so we couldn't help this woman. She was detoxing in our damn room. She could have died sitting in that room. You with us? Well, some of us understood what the deal was, and we got her to the right people so that she could get some help. But she's out there hiding out in AA because it was more convenient. I hear it all the time. There's more sobriety in AA. That's why I go there. Well, what a selfish thing to do. Go to the fellowship where you're supposed to be, and then there will be one strong person there to help the next person that comes down the pike. The arrogance of us to think we can help everybody. I'm going to need a bodyguard after this, I can tell you.
Peter. Speak in English.
Hi, my name's Peter and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Peter.
Just kind of carrying on from, I think it was Chris said this morning about sharing this message in, say, maybe a hostile meeting. One of the from my experience is that if I share first, I then have an hour of people counter-sharing. Now, if I share in the middle, within two shares, there's going to be somebody counter-sharing. If there's a newcomer in the room, he gets two messages. You know, I was 12-step a long time ago this way, kind of forgot it in the middle, and I'm doing it all over again. I was given a little card long, long time ago that said, I am responsible. If the hand of AA, I've got to be responsible. As far as I'm concerned, the hand of AA is 12 steps. If I go into a meeting and share that for the newcomer in the meeting and they get a counter message, for me, I don't know quite where to go with that because it could be confusing for the newcomer. If I'm the only voice in the room saying that, you know, and I am at times, you know, what? Please share your experience if you have any of that.
Let's just take a second. Peter. Brother, there's never been anybody that drew a sober breath, that didn't get a message out of the big book, that didn't confront that exact same situation at some point in their deal. Some of us stay with it for years, and some of us figure ways to get clear of it as best they can. If I was in your shoes doing that exact same thing, I would never forget the stuff that Chris said a little bit earlier. My allegiance my alliance, my heart goes out to the drunk that still suffers. And I will do anything to make sure that the drunk that still suffers gets the message that he needs to hear. A clear, concise message straight from the big book. If a man shares an opinion in a meeting and it has the power to kill, and I know it does, I guarantee you the meeting after the meeting is going to be quite exciting. I'll scoop that buddy up in a heartbeat, and we're gonna talk some, and I'm going to make sure that he understands that I'm not trying to bust anybody's chops, but there is some truth here. It's not a bunch of gray area and a bunch of opinion. There was a clear-cut set of directions, and that's what we're going to need to carry to this guy. I will never do it in the meeting because it just gets to be nasty. And so usually what I'll do is like you would do, I'll share as early in the meeting as I can, mainly because my guts won't let me sit still and listen to the crap for very much. By the time I'm to the end of those sick meetings, my guts are so tore up inside that I'm just going nuts. There are others, mercifully, that are not as weak as I am and are not as goofy as I am, and they can handle it just fine, and it's fine. But for those guys like me, share early, stay in the book, and then after the meeting, sashay up next to that little buckaroo and say, "Buddy, I know you heard some conflicting stuff in there. Perhaps we could talk for just a second, and let me tell you why I shared the way I did." It's great. Works good. Thanks, man.
I think anybody that's been in contemporary AA meetings has been faced with that. It's just, that's the bane. And that's why so many of us, after a period of time, you take a few shots to the jaw. You know, you go like, what is this really? Do I need to do this? You know, some of us get jaded. I was talking to some of us during the break at lunch, you know, and we were talking. Some of us just have a tendency to just go to our little big book thumper meetings where we can be insulated from that. Because I'm spoiled down there in the hill country because we all carry big books. We're all on the same page. But eventually you've got to branch out and start carrying the message back into some of these other meetings. And the bottom line is, and I don't want to offend anybody, spiritual program and all, there's another book that was written out there. I think some people, they call it the Bible, I think some people call it. And it talks about a spiritual path. Y'all with us? A little narrow path. The road less traveled. There's a reason it's less traveled. The why? Because it's a bitch. you get on the spiritual path, and it's like Bill Wilson. I hear people all the time that they misquote, but Bill Wilson, he wrote extensively. He says, in order to get sober, you've got to have two things, humility and responsibility. Okay, I'm humbly, I'm going to do this work. And then I have a responsibility to stand for what the book says. My sponsor, Mark H. out of Dallas, he says it all the time. You don't have to defend the big book. I'm not going to get in a pissing contest with anybody. What does the book say? I got a fatal illness. Am I going to bet my life on the opinion of some idiot in a meeting? Or am I going to go back to the literature and see what this literature says? Because this book has never lied to me, ever. It's told me some things I didn't want to look at. That's for damn sure. You know, I sometimes want to slide it off. You know, it's not always the easier, softer way here, you know. But it feels so good when you finally stand for something. And for every one of you that have taken those kind of shots, I just know you got a bunch of guys in Texas that are praying for you. Because it happens, no matter where we speak, it happens everywhere. So we're not gunslingers. We don't go in and look for a fight. I have this image out there that's what I do. I go into meetings, you get, that's not, it's just, I just don't, I'm just like Myers there. I don't do it. I don't fight in meetings, and I'm not going to, there for controversy. But if I see somebody being led down the wrong path, I'll snag his ass. Because that's my responsibility. Thanks.
Next question. Lady there. That side.
Hi, my name's Dawn. And I'm an alcoholic. You've touched on this morning already. But in my experience, it was a real priority. I was taken through the work very rapidly. In order to get a connection with the God of my understanding. And that's what saved my life, make no mistake about that. But what do you say to the people that say to these newcomers, easy does it, you were a long time getting sick and you're going to be a long time getting well, or 90 meetings and then we'll start your step work, or we'll start your steps in January. What do you say to these people, please? I don't mind.
I don't, I,
You tell them, shh. golly, I mean, but again, this is why it's tough for me to answer, because I'm blessed that I haven't been around that. But I do hear, you know, from the people that I come in contact with, when they've come from different groups and stuff like that, that's what they were told for so long. And they're weeping as they hear the true message is coming out of this deal. And for, you know, 15 treatment centers and they never heard it, or so many different AA meetings and they never heard this truth. And so, again, it's and correct me if I'm wrong here, but as opposed, you know, if I do hear someone sharing that kind of stuff and it is, you know, someone in the fellowship, then I... You know, my experience is different, and I need to stick with my book and my experience. And just like Chris said, my book says this. And the women that I come in contact with who've been misinformed over the years, and ask them, well, how well did that work for you? Yeah. You know, and usually they're able to see that it didn't work. And so then what we're going to do is we're going to go to the solution and show them the truth. And again, my responsibility as a sponsor is to sponsor correctly so that the next woman gets the correct message. And these people our little town there is there's a bunch of people that live in halfway houses and come and stay for a time in the Kerrville area. And I'll get to sponsor some of these women. And then they'll go back home to Dallas or to wherever they're from. And it's a pretty cool thing to know that the correct message is being sent home. And they're going to go back home to those meetings where they were told, easy does it, 90 meetings, 90 days, blah, blah, blah. And they're going to be able to be armed with the facts and to be able to stand up and start to change that area there. So, I don't know.
Here's the translation. When somebody comes up, I hear that often. We still, you know... Easy does it. You didn't get this sick overnight. You're not going to get well overnight. What that translates into, I don't have time to mess with you now. I mean, that's the truth. Book says we seek the solution with the desperation of a drowning man. It's on page 28. We seek the solution with the desperation of a drowning man. And that's what I had to do. Rapidly. I mean, the arrogance of us to think that this is going to take forever. I don't have forever to get well. I was talking to somebody in break. If my mind had not cleared up, folks, I mean, I came back in after a suicide attempt, and there was about 16,000 voices in my head telling me what a worthless piece of shit I was. And if somebody had told me that this was going to take forever to recover from, I would have just gone and finished the job. I was just, you know, just how it's very harmful. Again, it's taking stuff out of context. The book says we work the steps rapidly. Our history books explain that to us, and yet we still have people that want, because they were able to do that. You know, they didn't even start the steps for the first year they were sober, and so they believe that they should be. Maybe their disease hadn't progressed as far, but again, I go back to my premise. I have to assume that the person sitting across from me is dying of alcoholism, and at that point, I have a responsibility, if they're willing, to get them through this work as quick as possible, so we can have another man in the trench helping us, and that's the beauty of this program. So, bless you.
No, because I'm going to share some of that when I'm talking about
that. King of Chavs in the front row there.
It's really not true. welcome to London, guys. It's fantastic to see you. I'd just like to briefly start by saying how I admire and respect what you do, and I salute you for that. It really is fantastic stuff. Quite a contentious question, really, that goes around in AA. It's been brought up at my local intergroup, and there's been a few accusations fly around. But it's on the back of a line in our book, and it says that a man's mind must be cleared before he is approached. Do you take people through the steps while they're on mood or in chemicals, i.e. antidepressants and drugs like that? But yeah, it's quite a contentious one. But I've heard you answer that before, though, Chris, but I'd like to hear it again. It's great stuff. Thanks.
Next question.
If someone's detoxing heavily and under detox protocol, I don't mess with them. I mean, I love on them, get them some coffee, nice and easy until their head starts to clear a little bit. I believe, and this is my belief, you can do the work on certain medications and never have a problem with it. I'm a fan of antidepressants. I just think they're hugely overprescribed because they're prescribed mostly to treat what is the spiritual malady. And so a lot of people take them, they get on that roller coaster with the damn things and have a very difficult time getting off them. You have to be detoxed off antidepressants just like cocaine or anything else. It's just, it's nasty stuff. But it can be very beneficial in early sobriety. And so I believe if depression is killing you and you're on antidepressants and the pain will alleviate a little bit so that you can focus, I think we've done you a great service. My experience, and I'll share about it more in the morning, I was on 7 medications when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, came back in 1987, and began to work the steps immediately. And then over a period of the next 6 months, I detoxed off all of those antidepressants. And for 18 years, haven't had to take any medication. All the pills that they were giving me were for a reason, but they were all hooked to the spiritual malady, which was internal and couldn't be treated with a pill anyway. Make sense? If there was a pill that would fix what was wrong with us, guys, we would be rich. You know, we could do that. I think on some medications, I've been approached with people who wanted me to sponsor them on methadone, who wanted me to sponsor them on some anti-anxiety meds like benzodiazepines, and I won't sponsor them because it's just my own personal. They very seldom will have the experience that the book calls for because they're too heavily medicated, and it's difficult to do. But I'll be their buddy, and I'll try to help them any way I can. Sooner or later, we've got to let go of the chemical tether, you know, and just me in a dark room and God, and what's the answer going to be? And that's horrendously scary for some of us that were on medications for so long. That leap of faith we were talking about earlier. That answer your question, John? Okay.
I just want to add one little piece to the end of this thing. Real quick, on the same line of what you were talking about, though, time is of the essence. Let me give you a fast illustration. How many of you guys go to 12-step places like at a treatment center? A lot of us do for 12-step stuff. I mean, we go out and carry a message of the deal. How many of you guys have gone out at the beginning of a month? You got a brand new little buckaroo, and he's just checked in, and he's detoxing heavily, and he's just a shaky little mess of guy there. And he's standing there, and he's pliable. He'll do anything you ask him to do. He's willing to do the work. He's willing to do anything. He's hurting. He's just dying inside. Now, he's in the work and he's kind of doing what he's supposed to do. And then you leave him for a couple of weeks for whatever reason. And then you come back and see him towards the end of his stay in treatment. And now standing before you is this cocky little pissant who is now three weeks removed from his drug of choice there. And now we've got this guy whose internal condition, he's got 3 weeks of treatment and 3 weeks of medication and 3 weeks of everything telling him that he's okay. And he's bulletproof. We call it the AA Trinity. He's thinking about the job, the girl, and the car. That's all he's thinking about. He's not thinking about recovery anymore, and he's not thinking about it. This isn't in every case, but this is in a lot of cases. I work with a lot of guys. Most of the guys I work with are guys we scoop up out of treatment. And this is sort of the case. And so Bill and Bob and those guys understood that if we catch these guys as quickly as we possibly can and get them into the work as quickly as we possibly can while they're still hurting, they will seek the message with the desperation of a drowning man. There is no problem getting them to do that. It's only after their ego and arrogance begins to rekindle that you've got a problem on your hand trying to get them to see the truth. Yes, you can work them too fast. But in the big picture, the big cosmic picture, I'd rather see drunks working with guys too fast than waiting too long to get them through the work.
Yep.
Next question, lady in the white shirt there.
My name's Cammie, I'm an alcoholic. Thanks a lot for being here. I'm so glad that you kind of touched on the antidepressant thing. I'm a medical professional here, and I really try to pass on the message, and it is such a drinking culture. And I wanted to know, for someone who suffers with moderate mental illness, do you think it's more important to kind of get that stabilized first and then pass on, you know, and then pass on the message? Because sometimes I struggle. And what I've been doing, and I'm not sure if it's right, and I'd love to know what you think, but when I have patients in my room, I'll pick up the phone and call the AA helpline, and I'll pass it to them. and I've had one lady who is doing really well, but I'm just not really sure how to keep passing the message on, because it's really difficult. It's really difficult here, and I realize they have to be ready, and there aren't a lot of meetings in Birmingham, so, and they don't drive. I work in a real deprived area, but I was just curious to know what you think about it. And just when people do suffer from a mental illness, it seems like it really is hard for them. It's harder for them to get sober than just someone who doesn't.
You know, I work in the industry, so I can empathize with your plight. One of the responsibilities of those of us in the healthcare field are to qualify the person. We call it an assessment. We find out if what we're dealing with here is mental illness or what we're dealing with here is alcoholism or drug addiction. They look a lot alike. You know, you can't drive down the streets and see the old street people out there and just look at them and say, well, you're a drunk. You know, you can't do it, because some of them are suffering from some horrendous mental illnesses that can be treated with great therapy, and there are some tremendous medications out there that will help stabilize these folks. But at that point, where I get grindy is when we believe, as so many do, that the medications will fix everything. And it's like, it won't. There is no medication that will treat alcoholism and drug addiction. None. They can stabilize certain of our symptoms and get us on the level plan. Antidepressants are not a happy pill. I wish we had an hour just to talk about those damn things. It's just, they're not a happy, and everybody, but that's how it's presented. Are you depressed? Here's a pill. Oh, that's great. You know, another pill. It's the answer. And we take it. What it does is it just brings us back on the even playing field with everybody else. It doesn't get us above them. It stabilizes us so that we can now go and do the work. If we don't do the work, the pills will eventually destabilize, and we will be back in the mess again. What we see a lot of people do that leave our hospital, they leave on the meds, they get out for a period of time, they're doing really great, and then they just stop taking the meds. You know, it's like it's another form of self-medication. Oh, I can't afford the Paxil or whatever it is. I can't afford it, so I'm just going to stop taking it. And you can't do that. If any of y'all, if you don't hear anything else I say this weekend and you're taking antidepressants, understand that. Because if you just stop taking them, you will go nuts. And then you'll relapse 9 times out of 10. You don't do that. You wean yourself off just like anything else. It's just anything with medication, folks, with a doctor's care, very strict guidance. And it can be quite useful in early sobriety for some folks. And some folks are absolutely, it's necessary. Bless their hearts. I'm glad I don't have to deal with that today.
Question from the back at all? Oh, you had your hand up quite a long time next to Ian. Oh, the house DJ.
Hi, I'm Ronnie. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I just want to add my thanks for you guys coming over, but particularly the people who had the vision of organizing this. I have just got so much out of this weekend, and it's not even over yet. So a big thank you. My question kind of follows on from what people have already said. AA used to love me. When I was first around, every time I shared, people used to come up to me and gush. And then I got recovered, and they don't love me quite as much. I've just heard so much from you guys that I'm going to take back with me to where I live. And the area that I live in, it's not far from London, it's Cambridge. And as far as I know, I am the only recovered alcohol in my area. And we have, you know, I am blessed that there's lots of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. You know, there's probably about 20 a week, you know, at least 2 a day. And, you know, when I share, people take shots at me. And it's really tough. And I have actually people who are openly hostile to me now when I go to meetings. And you know, I sometimes don't want to go to a meeting because I don't want to be in that stuff. It's so toxic and it's so uncomfortable for me. And I've found I have to go to the areas where people are recovered and get fed and kind of come back. But I just wondered what your advice is really about what can I do? I mean, I'm going to start a meeting. I've already just realized I need to do that. But what I'm struggling is going to meetings when people are just very, very sick and they're taking shots at me and I'd leave there feeling worse than what I went in, and I just wanted to get some support and advice with that, really. Thanks.
Well, God bless you. I just want to weep when I hear that stuff, and it shouldn't be that way. Why is it that we seem to be beat up in our own fellowship? And it's an amazing deal. And people treat us like we're some kind of... start your other meeting. You know, I can tell you right now from being involved in setting up hundreds of meetings over the last 5 or 6 years through our website stuff of places all over the world. Before you set it up, though, you go back in there and tell them there's a crusty old Texan that would like to come back and kick some butt, because I can't stand that kind of narrow-minded horse crap. Let me tell you, the guys, I digress. I want to make sure that you understand that for every nutcase in that room that's taking your inventory and jamming you up, there's also one or two scared little rabbit guys sitting over to one side detoxing or real, real ambivalent about their recovery and not understanding what's going on. And you, kiddo, whether you know it or not, have the message of depth and weight. And I can assure you, the newcomer recognizes that. Everybody I've ever talked to that talked about starting a new group went through this exact same thing where they were going, I don't know how the guts to do it. I don't know if I have the knowledge to do it. I don't have the knowledge. Wait a minute, stop. You have the message to do it. You have the clear-cut message to do this. And the new guy recognizes the message of depth and weight. And what's the exciting part that you haven't got to yet that you will get to is that most of your detractors, most of the people that were the most vehement and absolutely attacking kind of people in this thing are the people that will slide up to you at some grocery store someday and say, do you think perhaps we could talk? How about some coffee? And there will be the guys that will be your greatest allies in the end. Over the years, we had detractors that were hugely, hugely anti-Big Book. I mean, to the point of fist fights in the parking lot kind of stuff, stupid stuff. And it's amazing how many of those guys within a 6 or 7 month period of time would come full circle, and I'd get a call in the middle of the night going, Myers, you don't remember me. My name's Andy. I go, oh, yeah, the guy in the fight stuff. Oh, yeah, yeah, listen, forgive me. I'm dying here. You think you could sponsor me? Yeah, brother, yeah. And pretty soon he's a little Big Book guy and it's all great. You know, this is God saying maybe it's time to go. It's time to go slide up there and do this thing. I don't think God ever wanted us to stand in a position where we have to take it on the chin every time we walk into a meeting. I don't think we were intended to be there. We'll just scoop up who we can. We'll go set up another meeting and we'll do it the way the book said do it. God bless you, man. Call me if I can help.
Probably the last one. Somebody. I'm gonna take the guy over there. Because we've not been over there. Over there, Bridie. Guy over there.
My name's Frank. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. It's to the guy on the left. I don't know what your name is, mate. I came in late there. But you spoke about the preamble, you know what I mean? And about the grapevine, digesting it. In our book, it says what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. Share in a general way, you know what I mean? I would just like to see what you've got to answer to that, what it says in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm. Oh, on his left? Is that right? I can do that real quick. Listen, there's nothing wrong with sharing experience, strength, and hope. If the person sharing it is an alcoholic, if they've been qualified and if they're doing the work, where we run into the problem is that the stuff that we talked on, that we alluded to earlier, you have a fellowship in the States, we've got a fellowship full, thousands and thousands of people who want to share all kinds of bizarre things in meetings, and the newcomer doesn't know what's truth. They don't know what's real book stuff. They don't know what'll kill them. And that's why we have to do the stuff. I'm not knocking, and I'm gathering that's what you're saying. I'm not jamming you up about sharing experience, strength, and hope. And I'm not jamming you up about that sort of thing. We just have to be really cautious about who we listen to. Not everybody sitting in our rooms is an alcoholic. Not everybody sitting in our rooms is a real-life drug addict. We have a lot of people that showed up at our fellowship that just got their butts on fire. They just got in trouble, and they needed to be someplace. And so they came, and they stayed. And I've never heard one piece of malice shared in a meeting, intentionally. I've never heard anybody come in and just to share a bunch of crap. People are sharing from love and devotion. People really care about us in this fellowship. The problem is that out of love, I can also share a lot of opinion that is not founded in any piece of literature. I can share a lot of things that perhaps have the ability to kill or harm somebody greatly. And we see that in the declining successes in our fellowship. Is that clear? If it's not, we can talk about it after the deal too, I promise. Experience strength and hope. And I'm going to talk about it more in the morning. One of the things that I think we all have to watch is the percentage of what we share in a meeting, experience, strength, and hope. A lot of times when we're sharing, we end up doing a little bit, 5% hope and 95% experience. And it's like, I'll translate that for you. War stories. And it's one of the biggest problems that we have in so many of all of our fellowships is that we got too many people out there thinking that the story is what's going to get somebody in here. And we do more damage with those stories than we do anything else. One-on-one, if I can feel you out a little bit, see where you're coming from, I can share some of our similarities and we can talk about some stories. But this idea of this blanket, just walking into a meeting, sharing our story, was never intended to be. 1970s, we had a little thing called a grapevine that came up with a great little article about open discussion meetings. And we can see statistically our success rates go straight through the toilet as a result of that. Early guys in Alcoholics Anonymous had two kinds of meetings. They had big book meetings where we studied the literature, and they had speaker meetings. Speaker meetings are where we share our experience. That's where we share our story. But in an open discussion meeting, guys, we're going to two or three meetings a week. We're going to hear your story every time we... Because you think that's all you have to share? I've said this from a million podiums. If all I have to share with you is my story, we are screwed. Because it can entertain you, maybe. It can get your attention, maybe. But it will never get you sober. Make sense? I mean, we've got to understand that our job here is to pull the newcomer with a vision of what life can be like in sobriety. And if we're not doing that, or if we're replacing it with just our story, we're boring the spit out of most people. That's what we're doing. We think it's great. We love to hear it. Oh, let me tell you about my dumpster again, But the little 19-year-old kid that's in the back, that's the real McCoy, that's dying of this disease, he just rolls his eyes and says, God, geez, I got to hear this again. You with us? Now, who's wrong here? I'm wrong. One-on-one, I could have made some headway with this kid. But I just scared him off with another stupid story. Make sense? And I know that's controversial. I know that grinds some of you. Because you've been doing it all your time in AA. So did I. Until somebody jerked me up and told me the difference. Share some hope, buddy, or keep your mouth shut.
Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of the question and answer. I was enjoying it. We're going to have a break, 15 minutes, and then come back and take your seats. Thanks very much, guys. Cheers.